This movie is one of those movies that I have seen end to end more times than my kids want to count. Because usually if it's on, if it's on, they know I'm going to watch it. If I'm flipping through the channels and I see it on the channel, I have to stop. Just to see where they're at in the story. I have no intention. I have no time to watch. But I got to see where they're at in the story. The Bubba Gump Shrimp Company restaurant that you go to when you're on vacation. And before you eat your meal, they want to ask you all these trivia questions about Forrest Gump. I have never met a waitress that can match me. I know this movie inside and out. Here's the question. Why do I like this movie? It's not because it's got some great moral fabric. During the course of the story, we witness just about every kind of sin you can think of. There's drug and alcohol abuse. There's cursing of God. There's sex. There's child molestation. There's rape. There's racism. There's lying. And there's cruelty to humans. It's not because it has some great plot. In fact, there is no plot. The entire plot of the movie is the fact that there's nothing more than just a bunch of random scenes threaded together by one guy's life that lived in each and every moment of the scenes. It's not because it's full of feel-good moments. There are some funny moments. I heard the laugh. There are some funny moments, but let's just be honest. This movie is built around tragedy and reality of war, death, and sorrow. It's not because it has a happy ending. Nope, that's not why I like this movie. Because when the story is over, you really have no idea if anything ever got resolved. Because what happens? The wind just starts to blow. So why do I like this movie? I think my infatuation this movie can be to the fact that I can relate to it from the perspective that I don't really think I understand life. What is the meaning of life? And this morning in January, when, you know, maybe you got up a little early and you're here and it's chilly outside and you're thinking about soup downstairs, that's really more of a philosophical question, and you don't want to go that philosophical this morning. How about we scale it back? What makes your life meaningful? Now, that's probably a question that we can answer better, but it's got a lot of things that I can plug in for an answer. God, family, church, country, job, hobby, or perhaps some other cause that you've gotten yourself involved into and you give resources to. I don't think I have my answer yet. So let's scale the question back another step and make it just a little more personal. What is the one thing in your life that, if it were gone, would leave your life meaningless? Now, I got something to think about. And I know I'm a preacher, and we're sitting in church, so everybody's expecting my answer had better be God. And please note, when I gave you my list, he was the first thing on my list. But I'd also like to point out that even Adam, in his perfect state, when he was faced with what was the most important thing in his life, he chose Eve over God. So I began to think about that, and let's just, again, be honest. There are many things in my life that on a regular basis I place ahead of God. Thus it stands to reason, if I had to pick one thing that gives my life meaning, the answer may not be so cut and dry as I would like to make it, where I just get to say, God. And then I try to convince myself, but God understands that, right? God's okay with that. It's okay. That's why we have things like grace and mercy and forgiveness, because I, Barry the human, have a really, 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 really hard time understanding what makes life meaningful. Hopefully your brains are churning right now, because that was my goal. Here's the good news. I don't want you to answer that question. I don't need you to tell me what makes your life meaningful, because right now, If I were to go around and I was to go person by person and ask you one at a time, we are sitting in a church, and I'm guaranteeing you the answer I'm going to get is either God or Jesus. I go back to Jacob Marshall. That was his theory. When anybody ever asks you a question in church, always answer it God or Jesus. You got a 50% chance of getting it right at that point. Okay, so that's the answer that you're going to give me. But I also know that come tomorrow morning, your life is going to shift gears. And well, for us normal human beings, the answer is also going to shift. After all, I've got places to go, people to see, things that need to get done, responsibilities that I have to attend to. And if I'm really, really lucky, maybe I can squeeze out a few moments for me. So how about we just skip the theatrics and just admit it? I want God to be the most meaningful thing in my life, but the reality is I got other things I'm chasing. And those things, well, they're attached to this world. Thus, if I'm going to live a meaningful life by my standard, it's almost impossible to be in this world, but not of this world. I can't even draw the line. There is no bright red line that says, this is in the world and this is of the world. And it's all, if you're trying to sort it that way, you will drive yourself insane. Because I don't think it can be done. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. Our teacher Solomon says this. I said to myself, come now and I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects, and I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves and flourish trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds of flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and treasure of the kings and providences. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well. The delight of a man's heart, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me, and all of this wisdom stayed with me. Pleasure. This is how it's defined, a feeling of happy satisfaction or enjoyment. Enjoyment and entertainment contrasted with things done out of necessity, an event or activity from which one derives enjoyment. Sensual gratification. I say that word, pleasure, and it just sounds worldly, doesn't it? Pleasure. Yeah, it just doesn't sound right. After all, we worship a serious God, don't we? I mean, that's who he is. We read through the Old Testament, and God is serious about this business. Yeah, I know. But did you ever think about it? God created you with the ability to experience pleasure. So if you believe in creation and you believe God assembled all of this, then you were created with the idea to be able to be pleasured. You have taste buds. You have a nervous system that you touch and you feel heat and you feel cold. You feel warmth and you feel things through your skin. You have eyes, ears. God designed you this way. And then here's the funny thing. He also put in place or in motion the things that we derive pleasure from. Would it not be easier to lose weight if sugar tasted nasty? Right? That would be so much easier in my life. I mean, would it not be easier if things didn't feel good? But they do. That's the way it works. Wouldn't it be awesome if my eyes didn't see anything but tragedy? Because then I wouldn't go chasing after beauty, right? What if my ears could only hear that which was bad? It'd be much easier to live my life. It would be really easy to say, well, that's bad because I can't hear it. And that's good because I would not have pleasure. It could all just go away. And so I want to say this because this morning we're going to talk about the pursuit of pleasure, but I don't want you to get this. God is not the no fun police. God is not anti-pleasure. He built you for it, and then he gave you things in your life that bring us pleasure. And you know what? When our teacher Solomon decides to go searching for the meaning of life, I am not surprised that he started with pleasure. You know why? Because it feels really good. It's a really good, fun place to start, isn't it? I mean, if I say, let's go and kneel and pray for an hour, I don't know about that, man. My knees, they just ain't what they used to be. And I'm probably going to fall asleep. And I can give you all kind of reasons, but I say, let's get together and let's have soup. Ooh, sign me up. Because I like the taste of soup, and that fills my stomach, and it makes me warm. And so it's really easy to like pleasure. Because, again, it feels so good. This is the reason people walk through art museums that I don't get. I don't see the beauty in a lot of paintings. People can look at it and say, oh, it's beautiful. This is the reason people like music more than me, because I am tone deaf. Okay? It doesn't matter what you sing. I'm tone deaf. I can't carry a tune in the bucket with a lid on it. Okay? It's just not me. But I can appreciate other people that have the ability to sing. Here's the other thing about pleasure. It's very addictive. You know what they all say? You can't just eat one, right? Lay's potato chips. You open the bag. You eat one. That one tasted kind of good. That one tasted even better. Oh, man. Yeah, and the first thing you know, you've got nothing but a crumply old bag that's empty because you ate the whole bag. It's addictive. Once you start down the pleasure road, your body is designed to enjoy pleasure. So let's talk about old Solomon for a minute, because this man went on a pleasure quest. Not a cruise. It was a quest. So what did Solomon try? Well, just think about it for a second. He tried laughter. I'll put on a happy face. I'll go to the comedy club. Make me laugh. It makes me feel better. He tried celebrating. He partied and partied and partied. He tried projects. We'll also call them hobbies. What did we read there in Ecclesiastes? I built a house for myself, or houses for myself. I planted vineyards. By the way, you know why he planted vineyards, right? That made it cheaper to have the parties, because now you have your own source of wine. So you can party more because you have more liquor. That was what he was doing. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. So, you know, he was a horticulturalist, and I guess he was a tree hugger, what we would call him, because he planted all of these things. And I made reservoirs and water groves and fruit trees. So he went into these social projects, and he was trying projects and hobbies. He tried to serve me. Oh, I like this one, right? Sit back in my lazy boy chair and put the thing up and cut the TV on and just say, yeah, bring me a drink. Bring me some chips. Bring me. I'm like in veg mode. You're laughing because there's a lot of us, this is what you're going to do this afternoon after your tummy gets all full of soup. You're going to find the most comfortable place you can to take a nap. Okay, because it's pleasurable. Serve me. He tried stuff. He was a collector. It says he owned more herds of camels and flocks and all the other things out there. He said he had more gold and silver, and he had all the treasures. So he was a collector of things, and this brought him pleasures. He tried art. I acquired female singers and male singers to come and sing to me. And yeah, I know, Barry said a bad word. He tried sex. And I'm not just talking about one night stand. Oh, no. What did he say? He said, I had a harem. So he had multiple. And just in case you think old Solomon didn't try your thing, at the closing of his Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he sits there in verse 10. He says, and by the way, in case I left something off my list, I denied myself nothing my eyes desire. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all of my labor, and this was the reward for my toil. So Solomon said, if you think you've got something else that you tried that I haven't, trust me, I tried it all. Everything out there that brings me pleasure, I tried it all, and I was entitled to it. It was my reward I deserve to have pleasure. But then we go just one verse later into verse 11. The cruise is over. Reality sets in, and this is how Solomon now talks about pleasure. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and all that I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless and chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. At some point, you get tired of your happy face, don't you? How many parties can you go to before there's just nothing left to celebrate? Did you see how his hobbies kept shifting? One house wasn't enough. I needed houses. One garden wasn't enough. I needed gardens. Being served, well, that's nice, but at some point, even that gets old. How many closets and storage buildings do you need full of stuff? How long can I write or paint pictures and they actually still have meaning? Even sex, at some point, it loses it. It's not as fun as it used to be. Solomon sums up his pleasure journey in chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. This is what he writes in a very poetic manner. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise and the house of mourning. But the heart of the fools is the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of the wise person than listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Do you see the irony of it all? Solomon was a man that could have anything and everything that he wants. And he literally ran out of things to want. What does this say about the man, the soldier that has no kingdoms left to conquer? Solomon reached that point on his pleasure. He had chased pleasure for the point that now he would rather die than do it again. Whew. That's dark. That's sad. It says he would rather hear an honest cry than another fake laugh. He's no longer just being interested in being entertained. He wants reality. He wants to know what the meaning of life is, because this isn't it. He goes so far as to say he now desires honest conversation over another meaningless song. He'd rather sit down and hear the truth and have somebody else just make it feel good for him. Can I just tell you? I don't know that I've ever gotten to this point in my life. Because I like to chase pleasure. I do. And well, the problem with the pursuit of pleasure is, and I look in our culture we live in, we are just people that are obsessed with pleasure. When I was a kid, yeah, I know, I'm old, I've got it now, okay? When I was a kid, we were happy we had 3 channels. And I know somebody here said that, well, all we had was a radio. I get that. Okay, we have 3 channels, and now we have, I've lost track. I think there's kind of like maybe 200, and that doesn't count streaming services. And why? Because I want to be entertained. Do you remember when going to King's Dominion or amusement park was a family vacation, and now we're season pass people that we like to go over and over and over again? Yeah. We're on pleasure quest. And the biggest issue is sometimes that pleasure quest, it goes both outside the church, but then it finds its way inside the church. And when I come here, I want to be entertained. I want you to make me feel good. Tell me something that's going to make me laugh, make me happy, make my life better, make me feel good about myself and my relationship. Give me something that I can take and make myself feel good. By the way, for those who say, well, that's not what I think about churches, that is the definition of entertainment. It was done purely for the purpose to make you feel good about yourself. That's entertainment. And we want this out of our churches, don't we? we want to be served. Oh, no, I don't. Oh, yeah, you do. Oh, yeah. Everybody likes to be served in the church. We like to be catered to. We want it to fit our style and our way and our methodology. I get it. And when I say everybody, I mean everybody. Everybody from the littlest one about this size and whoever the oldest member of the church is. Everybody likes to be served. We like to be focused on. Comfortable. You know what? Comfortable. Don't want it too hot. Don't want it too cold. I want the pad on my pew nice and soft. I want it in the right position. I don't want to knock my knees. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. We like comfortable, don't we? I mean, if you came in next week and the crazy minister had unscrewed all the pews and you came in, there was just a bunch of empty, floor. Say, we're going to sit on the floor today. Some of y'all look at it, well, I'm never getting back up again. The other ones would be like, that's not very comfortable. See, when we're looking at Solomon's pleasure cruise, did you notice something? What was the word that you saw over and over and over again he used? Did you catch it? I. Oh. He likes I. You like I? I like I. I? Yeah, that's me. But, you know, there's some things that we can look at in Solomon's little speech there about his pleasure cruise, his pleasure quest, that happens when you become an I-centric person. I allowed Solomon to think he was in control of his pleasure. Did you notice how he wrote things? I will test. I said. I wanted. I understood. See, that's what he was into. He was into, well, I'm in control of this quest, and so what I want is all that matters. This is for my benefit. I love it when we do votes somewhere. How do we usually do? Okay, if you agree, aye. If you don't agree, nay. And what are we after? Well, the ayes have it. Yeah, I, that's me. And then when I do that, it's really easy. I allow Solomon to take all the credit. Did you hear his words? I built. Really? Do you think he was actually out there with a hammer and nails building all this stuff? Seriously? I built? How about this one? We're having a lag this morning. There we go. All right. I made. Can you just see Solomon out there with his big royal robes and his nice gold crown and his nice shiny sandals? And he's out there digging the hole for one of them trees? He'd probably take a two scoops and say, oh, where's one of them servants I own? I got somebody else to take care of this hole digging stuff. He took all of the credit. The fact is, he acknowledged nobody but himself. Because guess what? He was putting the focus on himself. And then it begins to happen. I'm the focus. I'm in charge. It's all about me. And then I begin focus on the physical. It doesn't happen overnight. But you see how Solomon began to measure his life. I also owned. He threw in the word more. It wasn't just enough that he owned cattle and sheep and camels and donkeys and whatever else they counted as livestock those days. It isn't enough that he owned them. What was the actual goal? I own more. I have more than you. I have more than anybody. I am at the front of the line. Why? Because I own. It's mine. Count it up. My net worth is higher than yours. Therefore, I'm the important one here. I amassed. Boy, you think we're guilty today of amassing? Isn't it interesting? You know what one of the fastest growing industries in America is? Self-rental storage units. They're popping up everywhere. And you know what? There are people that have one, two, maybe three of these things that they're paying rent on. And they're not paying rent so they have somewhere to live. They're paying rent so they can store their stuff. Because we've amassed more than I can even fit inside of my life. And it's all important to me, and I can't get rid of any of it, because if I get rid of it, then I'm not who I am, right? This is not about just having money or things, folks. Hoarding for status. That's what Solomon got. I'm hoarding for status. You know I'm important because, look, I drive the nicest car in town. I got the biggest house in town. And my big house can't even hold my stuff. So now I got to rent about a dozen storage units to pay for it. Because, look, I got the stuff. And it's all mine. I. And since our stuff, our focus becomes our materials, I allows us to take and use people. Did you catch it really quick in his little soliloquy about his pleasureness? He says, I acquired. I have a typo there. But here's the thing. He's talking about people. Not cattle and cows and castles and things like that. He's not talking about this. He is sitting there talking about people. I bought, I acquired, they were my people. I owned the people. You see, this is huge. Because the only people that Solomon started thinking about were those who served him, those who sing to him, or those who serviced him. That's it. If you didn't fit in that category, you didn't do something for his life, if you didn't entertain him, if you served no purpose in his life, notice you're not even in the equation for him anymore. All about me. It's all about I. It's all about what I want. And folks, that's the pleasure trap. This is why the pleasure quest ends in meaninglessness, because guess what? I and pleasure indulges self. Okay? Anybody here ever just go to a movie because it's a movie? I've done that bunches. As a matter of fact, I can tell you a couple movies we went to, and before the movie was over, I thought, well, it's more pleasurable to take a nap than to keep watching this thing. But you get it, right? I want it to indulge me. And then what happens is the more I indulge self, the more selfish I become. So the more I begin to make my life about me, and I make my church about me, and I make my relationship with God about me, the more it becomes more about me, then the more selfish I become, and so the more I want it to be about me. And around and around and around and around it goes until I get to the point that nobody matters but me. It doesn't matter. You know what? If I didn't enjoy it, if it didn't speak to me, if it's not my style, then you know what? It's worldly. If I don't like the way you dress because you know what? That's not what I like, then how you dress must be worldly. If I don't like the way you sing because that's not the way I like to sing, well, how you sing is worldly. Don't we do this? You get it? This is where we end up when we begin to try to define worldliness by our pleasure. And we get to the point that we actually become blinded by our pleasure. Micah chapter 6, verse 8 reads, "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Did you notice in that entire big section that I read on Solomon's pleasure quest, how many times was God mentioned? Zero. Zero. So Solomon goes looking for the meaning of life, and he goes looking for pleasure, and the more pleasure I experience, eventually guess what happens? There's no even room for God. You know why? Because it's all about what I think. Yeah, that's it. It's all about what I believe. It's all about what I want. Forget about what God said. As long as at the end of the quest, I am pleased. That's harsh, isn't it? That's hard. Does that mean it's wrong to go to movies? No, movies are not wrong. Does it mean it's wrong to do this? Again, you're trying to define worldly by an act. I'm trying to get you to see worldly as the concept of an attitude. It's about I. Bubba had a plan. He was going to be a shrimping boat captain. Something that he truly found pleasure in. He knew every way there was to fix shrimp. There's a section in the movie where he's just sitting there listing off way after way after way after way that you can fix shrimp. He had actually sat down and done the math on how to make it all work out. He knew how much money he needed to have gas and how much to buy the boat. And he was going to live on the boat because that made expenses cheaper. And he had it all figured out about life. You know what? There was nothing wrong with this plan. Nothing wrong with being a shrimp boat captain. I'm happy there are shrimp boat captains out there because guess what? I like shrimp. You know, I do. I like seafood, and I'm happy that they're out there doing their job, and they bring it because shrimp brings me pleasure, especially when it's cooked in garlic and butter sauce, and yeah, it brings me pleasure. I like to eat shrimp. Nothing wrong with his plan. But here's the thing. As the wind blew, he died right there on the shore of Vietnam. And then you have to ask the question, what next? What was next for Bubba? Well, he died right there on the shore of Vietnam. So guess what? The next was what was next with God. Isaiah chapter 5, verses 11 through 13 says, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning and run after their drink, who stay up late at night till they're inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquet, pipes and trembles and wine. But they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the word of his hands. Therefore my people will go into exile," get this, "for a lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched of thirst." You know what the problem with pleasure is? Eventually, you end up in a life situation where there is no pleasure. Been there lately? I have. There's no fun to it. It's too hard. It's too difficult. It's too complicated. I want something else out of my life. And then what do? I wait for the wind to blow, right? Because this too is temporary and I'll just find my pleasure somewhere else. So let me encourage you as you begin to think about what is the meaning of life. If you're just living for the feel-good moment, understand you're going to eventually abandon God because it's going to become all about I.